Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Dingy, back-to-back houses, crowded into courts and alleys of incredible ugliness, with a complete disregard for light and air, noisy, smoky and odorous factories scattered at random among the residential parts of town, all lay under a perpetual pool of smoke from the maze of chimney pots. Desperate and expensive efforts were being made to rectify faults of 50 years standing, and the 20th century pendulum had swung to the other extreme with a vengeance. Narrow streets, which were death traps to modern traffic, were being widened at a fantastic cost. Well, we begin with fiction. In this case, Barhaven, a manufacturing town described by W. Stanley Sykes, a West Yorkshire doctor, in his much reprinted The Missing Moneylender of 1931, it captures a reality of both imagination and background experience for writer and reader alike. What I'm proposing to do in the midst of a general election campaign, and for the benefit of listeners who like to know where we are, it's the 4th of June at the moment, is to give you some relief, intellectual relief, from the difficulties of handling the complex rhetoric, the confusing ideology, the detailed prognoses of what they will do, the really, you know, sophisticated political offerings of Republican or Democrat alike, or to deal with some inconsequential election, Labour or Conservative or the others. And instead of which, we're going to do a series on the English town. I apologise to those who would like it to be the British town, but there's only so far that one's expertise can go. So this is a history of the English town designed to see us through much of the electoral campaign. So feel calm, think about towns in the past and breathe deeply. Or if you'd lived in Barhaven in that novel, don't try and breathe the air in at all. Towns were the worked environment reflecting past and present, their social experiences, economic opportunities, political shocks, cultural aspirations, and much else. They were those in the past, they are those today, and doubtless they'll be those in the future. Towns are also centres, both stages and subjects, for the collective imagination, and as such, their settings for most of our lives, and I'm assuming that the listeners here are not living in some obscure remote valley as a minority of the population, but are actually where the majority of the population lives, including for countries where the image is often more agricultural or outside non-urban, Australia, for example, as well as their counterpoints to each other, the towns and to the countryside. For English towns, there's an accumulative process to most of them. Most English towns, I mean, there are new towns, so-called, but most English towns go back a long way, at once constructive and destructive. Even the quieter country towns have seen a changing urban lifestyle and fabric. This was a process captured by novelists and honoured in sepia-tinged photographs, but otherwise often lost with the memories of the dying. Again, reflecting the extent to which detective novels, and I hope all listeners read my reviews of detective novels on The Critic Online, have to present what appears real as a background to their often slightly surprising and if not improbable plots. So Patricia Wentworth, a great writer of the 50s, in Anna, Where Are You?, a novel of 1953, wrote of a fictional town with its new bypass, the latter a feature of recent decades. Quote, Ledlington has a great many points in common with other county towns. Some of it is old and picturesque, and some of it is not. In the years between the two world wars, which for the Brits is 1918 to 39, its approaches have been cluttered up with small houses of every type and shape. There is Patricia Wentworth being slightly snobby about what we would call suburbia. When these have been passed, there are the tall, ugly houses of the late Victorian period, with their basements, their attics, their dismal outlook upon the shrubberies which screen them from the road. Still farther on, a beautiful Georgian house or two, or older still, the mellow red brick and hooded porch of Queen Anne's time, that's 1702 to 14, comfortable houses in their day, converted now for the most part to offices and flats. Here the road narrows to the High Street, winding among houses which were built in Elizabethan days, which for her obviously was Elizabeth I, 1558 to 1603. New fronts have been added to some, incongruous plate glass windows front the street. A turning on one side, very competently blocked by the quite hideous monument erected under William IV, that's 1830 to 37, to a former mayor, leads to the station, which for non-Brits means the railway station. Nothing more inconvenient could possibly have been devised. But the answer, of course, is that nobody devised it. Like nearly everything else in England, it just happened that way. Every few years, some iconoclast on the council proposes that the monument should be removed, but nothing is ever done about it. So, the history of English towns, whether factual or fictional, is a political, social, economic, and cultural history, the last in part illustrated by means of extensive quotations, which are always worth reading. You dip into any novel from the period, any newspaper, you will find something that is worth considering and much that is worth quoting. This is highly significant because towns and urban living took on meaning in large part due to their presentation. Now, of course, the nature of non-fictional urban sources are skewed towards the overlapping categories of government, the church, the educated, who tend to write the newspapers, and the wealthy. But there's plentiful other material, and it provides very instructive commentary, both in its own right and with reference to what it says of other sources. So for the 18th century, for example, there are the records left by Devizes, Baker, there are references by other craftsmen, people who were literate. Now, they tend to be possibly more commonly non-conformist, so they might be argued as atypical, but nevertheless, they show that it's not just the wealthy or the elite that are, as it were, owning the past and presenting it, to use rather silly modern language. So also with the light thrown by the interest in urban history, although in recent centuries this hasn't been as central as fiction. So it's significant that urban history enjoyed prominence in the early modern period, which most people would say is 16th, 17th century, in large part as an aspect of urban identity at a time of specific political and economic disputes over town interests. Now, that's very different to the modern context for urban history, which tends to be more academic in its forms and content. From the Roman period on, towns were vital spheres of national life and important forcing houses for modernization and modernity. They constituted the living space of the most articulate and the best informed members of society, indeed of the urbane, to play with the language. Furthermore, they were one of the principal products of human activity, the section of the environment most amenable to action, and of society most open to regulation. And I'm sure that's also going to be the case if the new government is, as is widely anticipated, a Labour government. Indeed, town planning, whether achieved or only an aspiration, revealed concern with a host of issues, much of them to do with political power and social ideas and ideology, however much they might be presented in utilitarian grounds as to do with air and light, public hygiene and open spaces. In the past as in the present, the creation of a regulated environment is not simply functional in its rationale, for example, seeking to improve transport. This creation also reflects an intellectual plan based upon moral vision. Well, I dare say that's how Mr. Starmer or his opponents would like to see themselves, an attempt to create harmony upon earth, a spirit of change. Indeed, Daniel Defoe captured this in terms of divine intentions, writing in his A Tour Through the Whole Island of Great Britain, which came out between 1724 and 27, of Harwich, not a town that most of us would think about in terms of divine intervention, but there you are, the doings of Providence are always surprising. Quote, "I cannot think but that Providence, which made nothing in vain, cannot have reserved so useful, so convenient a port to lie vacant in the world, but that the time will sometime or other come, especially considering the improving temper of the present age, when some peculiar beneficial business may be found out to make the port of Ipswich," so Harwich being the port of Ipswich, "as useful to the world and the town, as flourishing as nature has made it proper and capable to be." In fact, it ended up with Felixstowe, which took that role and is now one of the most important ports in the country. So the specific manifestations of the spirit of change ranged from new drains and larger police forces to religious renewal. But the need for conscious direction and improvements to the urban environment was widely accepted. Much action derived from the scale of the resulting issues facing urban communities, as well as central government, from disorder and crime to poverty and pollution. The desire for improvement repeatedly created issues, as did the inherent situation. It's impossible, of course, to tell national history without understanding this urban experience. For each town, their particular position, their relative ranking, their environmental impact, physical structure, economic significance, social experience, and cultural standing and contribution are all important factors. And in aggregate, they are significant as many of the themes of nationhood that are often brought out and at least constitute some of these themes. Most of us in England live in towns, settlements larger than villages. The same is true of Britain as a whole and Europe, indeed the world. But the history of English towns is that of the first major modern country that urbanised, and with urbanisation a key part of its national history. So town history, in the case of Britain, is also national history. Let's turn to two other quotations to take us forward. One is from John Evelyn, not the famous writer of the 1660s, another John Evelyn, writing in Cornwall in 1702. Quote, "The infamous borough of Mitchell, a paltry village consisting of about 20 poor thatched cottages. The chief support of the place is election for burgesses, at which time they make no scruple of selling their votes to the highest bidder, and afterwards inform against their benefactors if the adverse party will bribe them to it." We're not describing here members of the modern House of Lords, but what we were talking about is John Evelyn talking about what was known as a rotten borough. This returned two members of Parliament from 1547 to 1832. In 1831, there were only seven voters. But it was a town. It was a borough, if you are going to use that as the definition of a town. Another quote. In Agatha Christie's novel, The ABC Murders of 1936, "He may be in your town," the caption in the fictional Daily Flicker, which is focusing on a crime wave, the person that has murdered people in eight towns beginning with A, B and C, captured the identification of people and place that made towns so much more important. From the 1851 census, Britain has had an urban majority, defined then in terms of settlements of over 2,000 inhabitants. A definition, moreover, to which did not capture the extent to which there were also short-term visitors to towns from the surrounding hinterland for work and or leisure, thereby driving up the population. Towns, large or small, have been the setting for an experience that is not defined by the touchstones and timetables and the pressures of rural life. Town life has also alarmed many. Turning back to 1763, Lieutenant General Joseph York, son of a Lord Chancellor, a Member of Parliament and a diplomat, was in no doubt about the problem posed by London. And it's worth thinking about this remark because it sort of echoes across the centuries, might even echo today. Don't you think that the overgrown size of our metropolis is one great cause of the frivolousness, idleness, and debauchery of the times? I have often wondered that the legislature has not long since laboured to put bounds to its increase, for it is really too big for the good observance of the law of the gospel. A weak police can lay but little restraint upon such multitudes. The capital, London, clearly so from the 11th century, and large towns more generally, have greatly influenced notions of urban life. But discussion of London, always the largest town over the last millennium, and indeed for nearly two millennia, insofar as estimates are possible for the first post-Roman centuries, which is not easy, has had a disproportionate impact on the account of English urban history. It had exceptional features due to scale and function, but in addition, in practice, much seen in the capital was a matter of quantitative rather than qualitative difference being also found elsewhere. Towns, for example, were the central points in the overlapping worlds of crime. They provided a concentration of victims and a recruiting ground for and off criminals. As a result, crime both affected urban living, as with the development of home security, and was affected by it, as in the opportunities and challenges posed. Moreover, crime helped affect the images and anxieties of urban life. Thus, Thomas Dekker, a Elizabethan and Jacobean playwright, depicted urban swindlers, as in his play The Bellman of London, 1608. He depicted them as organising themselves as if in a shadow economy, and part of an overlap between criminality and the non-criminal world, which was seen as focused in London. This overlap was taken further in themes of a similar organisational and structure and ethos, seen, for example, in John Gay's The Beggar's Opera of 1728, in which London as the capital of the state was a parallel to London as the capital of crime. Towns were also the key markets for stolen goods and the places where there were established networks dealing in new or second-hand goods that could be used by criminals, part of the interplay, indeed, of makeshift economies and criminality. This situation continues to the present, so towns are the central places for drug dealing and for the sale of contraband cigarettes. The so-called county lines in drug dealing originate in towns and are controlled from them. As prisons were usually in towns, it is worth remembering that part of the urban population were the detained, whether or not their offences were urban or rural in their location. For example, in early 1678, the County House of Correction at Stafford, we'd called it the prison, established in 1649, held 10 prisoners, three men for being pilferers, two for being idle and leading a bad course of life, one woman for pilfering, two for being idle and disorderly, one for being very disorderly, and one for having bastards, the last a cause of extra cost for the poor rate. Indeed, prostitution was part of urban life in particular. In his novel Mole Flanders, Daniel Defoe described this as of considerable scale in London and also as bringing the risk of venereal disease. Quote, sowing the contagion in the lifeblood of his posterity, when he is, as it were, drunk in the ecstasy of his wicked pleasures, her hands are in his pockets, supplementing her income through theft. Defoe, of course, was a nonconformist. That was a particularly bleak and hostile view of casual sex. Similarly, with the staging in towns of what historians termed the moral economy of the crowd, it was commonplace to see action being undertaken to ensure appropriate conduct, an instance of which was reported in Barrow's Worcester Journal in its issue of the 25th of September, 1766. Quote, yesterday there was a great disturbance here, that's Worcester, occasioned by the market people asking eightpence and some ninepence a pound for butter and refusing to take sixpence, whereupon the populace seized several baskets and sold out the butter at sixpence per pound. Such activism was also seen in rural areas, but was more present in the towns and for both prices and wages. It could rest on desperation. as noted in the report from Durham in the Daily Post, which was a London newspaper, of the 30th of January 1731, when of course it was cold. Great numbers of the wives and children of the coal pit men are begging about in all the neighbouring towns by reasons their husbands have not their usual work and are forced to draw coals about for small pay to prevent starving. We are in great dread of them. A sense of popular life as out of control linked moralists across the ages, although they were inclined to downplay the extent to which there were still rules in the sense of conventions in such activity. So in his tour, Defoe was harsh in his account of Charlton Horn Fair, a scene of popular festivities held at Cuckold's Point on the Thames east of London until in 1872 it was closed for its disorder. This is Defoe writing. The yearly collected rabble of mad people at Horn Fair, the rudeness of which I cannot but think is such as ought to be suppressed. And indeed, in a well-civilized, well-governed nation, it may well be said to be insufferable. The mob, indeed, at that time take all kinds of liberties, and the women are especially impudent for that day, as if it was a day that justified the giving themselves a loose to all manner of indecency and immodesty without any reproach or without suffering the censure which such behaviour would deserve at another time. I recommend it to the public justice to be suppressed as a nuisance and offence to all sober people. Now, I think it's fair to say that in urban life in England, and the same would be true in other countries, the view of somebody like Defoe as a reformer and an improver, self-styled and in both reason and conceit, tends to take dominance. You don't tend to hear about views that are opposed to this. And I suspect it will be the case as well when modern English urban history is considered. So you'll hear a lot about how towns wish to have impact zones, making it very difficult to drive, and you will hear very little about those seriously inconvenienced and often put in great difficulties financially and in other respects by such zones. And I suspect the same will go on being true. There were also potential political aspects of disorder. So during the 1722 elections, writing just before Defoe, John Lord Percival, a Whig, reported of the Tory opposition, quote, "The mob, which is generally high church, have, where they are strongest, been insufferably rude, as at Westminster, Reading, Stafford, etc." Of course, your supporters were always the people, your opponents were always the mob. It is ever thus. So I am a Democrat, you are a populist. It is ever thus. And of course, there is a crudeness about that analysis, but also a self-serving character that one needs to guard up against when one was thinking about political history or urban history. Writing from York the previous year to an opposition political ally, so from the opposite side of Percival, Philip I, Duke of Wharton, provided evidence of the impact, however short-lived, of the bursting of the fraudulent financial speculation of the South Sea bubble on that town, as well as illustrating the ambiguous nature of contemporary evidence. So, for example, the city itself is but poor, the trade being very low, and the last stroke to our credit has completed their misery. On the other hand, everything is excessive cheap, which in some degree makes amends for the scarcity. Where do you put the focus if you're doing history? York, however, indeed, was not conspicuous in the 1720s as an example of civic decline. There was extensive building in the city, a new mansion house testified to civic pride and wealth, and York sustained an active local press. Wharton's letter, indeed, can be seen as an unreliable source, one written for political purposes, the description of York to be repeated to others as a proof of the terrible impact of the fiscal situation, which was, of course, blamed on the Whigs, because they were the government. On the other hand, in 1722, a following year, a Tory was one of the two MPs elected from York, unlike in the general elections of 1715 and 27 and the by-election of 1725. So in other words, evidence of the general prosperity of the period in York shouldn't detract from the seriousness of the short-term problems. And again, that puts a question of where the historian should put their emphasis. How far the same point can be made for other instances of evidence repays consideration. Differently, in 1773, George III reflected on the contrasts in urban opinion when he left London, where criticism of him and the government was vociferous and had been so since 1761, to visit Portsmouth. This was a town where, in contrast to the usual situation, with ports being particular centres of illegality due to the prevalence of smuggling and the evasion of duty, the presence of the leading naval base resulted in an attitude of loyalty, one that was to be repeated when George visited Portsmouth again in 1778. On the former occasion, the painter Joshua Reynolds observed, "The king is exceeding delighted with his reception at Portsmouth. He said to a person about that he was convinced he was not so unpopular as the newspapers would represent him to be. The acclamations of the people were indeed prodigious. On his return, all the country assembled in the towns where he changed horses. At Godalming, every man had a branch of a tree in his hand, and every woman a nosegay, which they had presented to the king, the horses moving as slow as possible, till he was up to the knees in flowers, and they were all singing in a tumultuous manner, 'God save the king.' The king was so affected that he couldn't refrain shedding abundance of tears, and even joined in the chorus." Now, the point about that evidence is this. The usual line on the towns in this period, one encapsulated but not only represented in John Brewer's book on sort of radical politics under Wilkes, is the argument that towns were the centres of urban radicalism. Well, some may well have been, but it's actually also the case that some clearly were not. You clearly have to think of different moments. And there may also be the case, shock horror, of historians, like in this case Brewer, assembling evidence that supports their thesis rather than considering the full range of possibilities. And I think that's more generally the case, certainly in consideration of the 1760s, 70s, 80s, but also when people look at the 1790s, 1800s, 18-teens, 1820s, when again, they're apt to focus on radicalism and not to consider towns which were clearly not so radical, and urban occasions and moments that were, this was not the case. So, and this is the point I want to focus on, there are problems involved in assessing the evidence of trends, as well as the perceptions of contemporaries, as with the observation that towns are forever declining from some golden age in the distant and undefined past. I think that's a very pertinent point, because there's always some golden age in the past. There is also, in discussing urban politics, the vexed question of how far policy and separately change are to be explained by elite wishes, and how far popular agency played a role. So I'm trying to offer a long-term perspective that captures the reality of the reworking of towns and neighbourhoods to reflect changing needs and opportunities. So this is not unproblematic or uncontentious. I want to emphasise that at the start. There is a danger that a general account can smooth out elements. So on the 25th of May 1924, The Times noted, or claimed, I should say, "The life of England becomes every day more urban, and yet the people never cared more about the country." Well, we can discuss how far that the latter was true, that not everybody, that clearly was it the case, but they certainly are capturing a contrast. Moreover, alongside growth, permanence and durability can come decline and crisis, either for towns as a whole or for sections of both towns and their population. This is an aspect of the complexity that is central for town life and urban fortune. They require reasons for sustaining prosperity, not least in order to provide for the resources and services they receive. Now, recently, of course, that process has been provided in part, in large part, by redistributive taxation and the consequent funding of social welfare, so that towns that contribute very little, their people are kept going. But I think it's fair to say that that is a relatively recent innovation, and from the outset, towns required reasons to exist and to grow. Nothing was inevitable. And at that point, Graham, I wonder if you've got any questions, because that's a good point to break, and we can continue next time.
Well, it certainly is, Jeremy. And my introductory thought is to wonder how, particularly when we think about those writing about towns in newspapers, journals, and novels and so on in the 18th century, how that might have been different from a later perspective. So the big growth of industrialized cities in the 19th century, does that cast towns, market town-sized towns, in a different light? Or when we are thinking about the 18th century, because these outside London and Bristol, these very large cities don't exist in England, is it, you know, the towns are the nearest we get to that? So they are seen as the repository of crime and vice and so on. Does the development of bigger cities almost whitewash towns in popular perception as a result? They no longer seem so iniquitous.
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I think we'll come to that when we look at the 18th and 19th century. But I think the issue of the city in the 19th century is dramatically changed by the scale of places other than London. So prior to that, the biggest cities, Norwich, Bristol, Exeter even, York, are places that are not particularly large. But the situation, with the countryside always literally in view, but the situation dramatically changes in the 19th century, and I think we should really consider that separately, if you don't mind.
Yes, of course. Well, I'm interested by the points you make about towns not necessarily always being centres of political radicalism, and you know, there's variation, and you know, for example, Royal Navy port cities, you know, were naturally royalist. I mean, they knew where their bread is buttered in that sense. Is there, and my mind is focused on the 18th century in asking this question, is there nevertheless a pattern between Tory and Whig in borough MPs being sent back that is discernible beyond things such as state patronage? Or is that not the case? It's really, you know, in the case of rotten boroughs, it's, you know, whoever controls the local interest and so on. Or can we see actual urban radicalism in these towns as something which really drives, which is can be quite consistent across England?
No, what I would say is that if you're looking at towns which in the early 18th century can be considered as Whig or Tory, it's often the legacy of the 17th century that's crucial, that legacy being in particular those towns which were more strongly non-conformist, a place like Taunton, for example, and those towns which were more strongly Anglican and generally royalist and often Tory. Worcester has a more Anglican tradition than Taunton. And I would say religion is a key element, that places which are strong with dissenters tended to be Whig in the 18th century, and those which were more commonly centres of the Church of England tended to be Tory.
Mm-hmm. So you have that ecclesiastical role. What about those towns which are market towns? Does being a market town affect the nature and politics, particularly as distinct from other towns that didn't have that function?
Well, just about everywhere is a market town of some type or other. I mean, I think that, you know, in a way, we're talking with the measure of politics is a complicated one, because you have to bear in mind that whereas today parliamentary elections reflect those who choose to vote above the part of the voting age, the vast majority of whom are permitted to vote, that was not the case in the 18th century. And you can easily have a situation in which those who Percival refers to in 1722 as the mob are a majority for one political party, but the others, you know, the franchise is very restricted, maybe just members of the corporation or maybe burgage In burgage towns, those who own specific pieces of property, and they may therefore return a member of parliament who doesn't reflect the majority view insofar as we can tell it.
Do we see much evidence of the strength of local corporations in a relationship between the development of towns, or is there no very obvious correlation between the strength and purposefulness of local corporations and actually the fortunes of a town, which may be dependent on all sorts of other factors?
Oh, all sorts of factors play an enormous role, but it's generally unique to individual towns. There's very little cooperation between towns, and there's no equivalent to the North German Hanseatic Confederation or the Lombard League of Northern Italy. Towns are very much on their own, if you see what I mean.
Well, this is a very interesting start to a new series, and I want to leave it there for now, but we will carry on with this as we look at the development of towns across the period. But for starting this new series on the English town, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.